Good method of mine is getting into a sort of publication. It's been lying around for a long time. And I was waiting for a call for it. It's called Philosophy of Consciousness Without an Object, which I imagine doesn't mean much. First, I had decided that I would not subsidize its publication, that I'd wait until there was some call for it from outside. At last it came, and the spark plug in this effort is our friend Bruce over here. In Dorothy and Mrs. Bates and one or two other guests and so on undertook a task which they greatly underestimated. For it's about 200,000 words, and to put that on stencil and copy is quite an order. Now there is one thing, Dr. Reinel, I want very much, and that is what we might call feedback, to use a modern term. I know what I mean. I don't know what the reader gets from it. I might illustrate that in this way. Suppose somebody were to write up a description of color in all of its uses and its relationships and so on, and were to transfer his account to Braille, and was read by an intelligent person but born blind. What would he get out of it? Now, I don't mean the physicist's interpretation of color, which he might conceivably grasp, because that is very largely a mathematical conception. And assuming that a man born blind has full intelligence, he could conceivably grasp such physical ideas. But this is a description of color in its sensuous quality, as seen. What could such a person derive from the description? No development of his conceptual skills would give him the immediate quail of color. Now, let us assume that he dwelt upon the description in an essentially meditative way, protractedly, insistently. It is conceivable that he might arouse into activity what is called the direct action of the sense mind. Laura Bendel said something about the direct action of the sense mind, which I can partially verify through the testimony of a person I knew many years ago. But when the sense mind is functioning fully, it can replace the office of the sense organ, so that direct sensuous perception is possible without the intervention of a sense organ. A person I knew many years ago had been under training by a hymn girl, whom she called Swamiji. And for a period, she did have the experience that she could see her environment, the physical outer environment that we lived here, with her eyes closed, to wash dishes, perform other housework, and see around her, see what she was doing with the eyes closed. I don't have any other verification of this possibility, but it is so affirmed by Sri Aurobindo. Now we have a problem. My concern is with what would be, in even the strict sense, a metaphysical subject matter. Anyone who's known the story of philosophy knows what led up to the writing of the Critique of Pure Reason, namely the development of criticism of our knowledge through John Locke, Berkeley, David Hume. And David Hume awoke Kant from his dogmatic slumbers. The outcome of that was this conclusion, put in simple terms, that by means of a twofold main means of cognition, namely sense perception and conceptual cognition alone, a metaphysical subject matter is inaccessible and becomes purely a speculation. And metaphysical ideas ultimately then become in the hands of Carl G. Jung, no more than a projection. We have there added to epistemological criticism, psychological criticism. But one of the questions asked by Kant in his introduction is, why do we have a metaphysical disposition? And Kant was not lacking in that disposition, for he was very much concerned about the three metaphysical problems of God, freedom, and immortality. I don't think that what he contributed in an effort to reestablish some knowledge was too successful. But he had the disposition. And it's a very important question. Why does man have a disposition that aims at the metaphysical? Now let us say a word about what we mean by metaphysical. The word is used loosely so much. I'd say a source of knowledge that is non-empiric. The usual term is a priori. And in the light of the epistemological criticism, we'd have to say that it is non-conceptual. If there is to be any such thing as a truly metaphysical knowledge, something more is required. Now the answers of Jung give us simply what we might call a psychological disposition. It says explicitly that our metaphysical statements are merely statements as to the structure of the mind. The only door out of being locked in to purely individual mental function, he finds only through an irrational door, penetration into the unconscious. And bear in mind, he defines irrational not necessarily in the sense of being against reason, but not in the province of reason also, and it's in that sense I understand it. He reveals, of course, in his book, in his last book, the one he wouldn't allow to be published during his lifetime, not a scientific work this time, but the story of the man, Dr. Carl G. Jung. The man who, in the deep sense of the word, not the conventional, was religious, and did have the feeling for the beyond. It's evident in that book right there. Value it much more than his scientific work comes to the last analysis. Now there's one question not answered by Jung. A question put by Kant. How is pure mathematics possible? Or as he says, it is evident that pure mathematics consists of synthetical judgments a priori. I conceive that to be a very important question, and that it ties in to the question of whether ultimately a pure metaphysical knowledge is possible. Now, back in, I had the good fortune to win a scholarship from the Harvard Club of San Francisco, and at the close of my fifth year at Stanford, this gave me a year at Harvard in the Graduate School of Philosophy there. During that year, I took two seminars, one under Bakewell, who came up from Yale, in which all sorts of metaphysical questions were discussed. We each wrote a paper, an hour's paper about. And one would deliver a paper, and the others could break in at any moment, tear you to pieces, and you had to keep yourself from being torn to pieces if you could. Very excellent discipline. I wrote a paper that developed a thought in the line of the Vedanta. One of the brilliant students, a Scotchman, come from Europe, fellow, and he defended it successfully against all criticism, and that impressed me. Thought came to me that this problem may be due to the fact that we have latent organs of cognition other than sense perception and conceptual cognition. And if such organ exists, then it's useless to argue on these problems until you determine what may be known in such a way. Otherwise, it's just a mental exercise going around in a circle and leading nowhere. I decided to make the search for that organ, if there was such. The problem is the problem of yoga. Well, I left the academic world, and I went through the passage of what Ralph Martin Perry called the intellectual underworld. Reminds me of the fact that Young says the pearl without price is found in the mud, and in a certain sense, that's about the way it feels when you go through the intellectual underworld after you've been in the university. James did that, you know, around Boston. I did it around Boston, and I came across his trail, too. There. Well, after 24 years, I came up with success. And the effort was well worthwhile. It was worth a whole lot more than an academic career or any other possible career. I did make the yogic breakthrough, and not in a small way. That is recorded in Pathways Through to Space, a record taken during the process. In this book, the first part is taken up principally with a recapitulation after fact of what you might call the subjective material bearing on the process. And the reason for doing this is that I couldn't find that material. When James wrote his Varieties of Religious Experience, he complained of the fact that this subjective autobiographical material was scarce. It could be found in the case of some Western mystics, but practically not at all in the case of the Oriental mystics. For the Oriental mystics emerge with a philosophy or a system of metaphysics or a work of art, poetry or whatnot. They don't tell you what you actually go through, the kind of material that is of interest psychologically. I know one is a bit diffident about it. It's what Young has done in that book, what Aurobindo has done in his letters. Because it's a little like a lady say, slip is showing, so forth. Yeah. You feel diffident and so on. But I studied it. I said this would have been valuable if I could have found it, so I think I'll leave the trail. Just what goes on in your consciousness when you go through the experience or experience of transformation in consciousness. Not only what it means psychologically, what it might mean philosophically, but what is it psychologically? If you leave yourself vulnerable to criticism and all that, but I thought it was potentially of sufficient value to justify it. I've had a series of five realizations. That's the term by which we know. It's a term used by Aurobindo, but it's used by Shankara, and I'd use it quite independently of Aurobindo. In the progressive series, four of them I sought. The fifth and most profound was an utter surprise. It just walked in mind to me. 33 days after the preceding one, which was also major, and followed the pattern of Shankar. This was totally new. It's very difficult to find any reference in literature at all bearing upon it. But it did involve a progressive development at the peak of which the subject to consciousness, the self, dropped away, and the object of consciousness dropped away, and only consciousness remained. And one refers to that as an experience of Orientals in his psychological commentary to the Tibetan Book of the Great Realization. He says he can't imagine such a state, but he says apparently to the Orientals they have no difficulty. And they'll say that this is real knowledge. And in contrast to that, our ordinary knowledge is ignorance in the sense of avidya. And he doesn't challenge that it is possible. He simply says you can't imagine it. And I can quite agree that our background of the process of cognition is such that we cannot imagine how there can be a consciousness without a cognizer and a subject that is conscious. There is a reference. By the way, could I get the Tibetan Book of the Dead? Only recently I found this verification.
Do you mind the interruption?
No, but
you know, I was just wondering whether you would consider that in some cases in sense experience there is, or in sense imagination, there is something like an image of that. I mean, this is Plato says that ordinary objects are images of form. So that in sense experience to me that there is something that is like what you're describing. And that is, if you take the room and abstract from your memory, abstract from your anticipations, that you see you're looking at your hands here, but and you look at any object and you don't think of, you know, where it came from, what it is, whether it's separated from anything. All these qualitative differences are present. But then, you know, when you're no longer anticipating doing anything yourself, when your body seems to be, you know, just a qualitative difference from the rug rather than a separate thing, then the consciousness of a perceiver, it seems to me, would vanish here, because the subject-object involves you, you know, about to do things that other things don't do, doing these two things that they've done too. I can see how in that sense the distinction between subject and object
and
would evaporate.
Evaporate.
So it's a projection. I mean, it isn't an you don't experience that, but you can, in some sense, schematically imagine.
Well, no, I know. No, I see what you mean by imagining there, yeah. In the footnote to the text of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, he uses the Tibetan term rigpa, meaning consciousness as distinct from the knowing faculty. by which it cognizes or knows itself to be. Now, I have to make use of just the distinction that's coming here. I have called consciousness in the sense of Rigpa as a substantive consciousness. In contrast, I have this whole idea of being in contrast to the knowing aspect of consciousness. Ordinarily, Rigpa and Shirig are synonymous, but in an abstruse philosophical treatise as in here, Rigpa refers to the consciousness in its purest and most spiritual, namely, supermundane aspect, and Shirig to the consciousness in that grosser aspect, not purely spiritual, whereby cognizance of phenomena is present. Now, it's in a latter sense we usually use the term, of course, as consciousness of phenomena, namely, something around, a world about. The whole cosmos is just phenomena in this sense. Now, subtilize the shearing to the point that the content of consciousness is just consciousness and not phenomena. And then it speaks about what that means. Let's see if I remember where it is. Oh, yes, from the union of these two states of mind or consciousness, implied by the two terms Rigpa and Shirig, and symbolized by the all-good father and the all-good mother, is born the state of Dharmakaya, the state of perfect enlightenment, Buddha. Now that stuff was familiar. I didn't know that anybody else had used terms, though I've been hunting until I found it right there. With the two centers of consciousness. This is a little bit different from just what I say, but there is implied here not a consciousness in the sense of a relationship between me and an own, and an object, a phenomenal object, which is our ordinary use of the term, of course. I know that the whole world outside. Now, think of all of that not as non-conscious thing, mountain, tree, house, cosmos, or whatnot, but as object of consciousness. And I here cognize that in the relationship between is consciousness. James denies, as you may remember someplace, that consciousness exists in the sense of being other than a relationship. Now there, of course, I take strong reservation based upon actual realism. The consciousness can be the actual substance of which all content of consciousness is made, and the actual source of the subject to consciousness. And you take this in connection with a certain statement in the Mystery of Buddha that is written by H.E.B. from materials drawn from Tibetan sources, where it says that Gautama was an avatar in the sense that Adi Buddha, he was an avatar of Adi Buddha, which is translated primordial wisdom, not a primordial entity, but primordial wisdom. a quality of consciousness now, Mark. This is very revolutionary from all habits of Western religiosity or Western psychology and so on. And these, if it appeals to you as meaningless concepts, don't trouble about it. You can play with the concepts, even if you can't imagine what it means. That a quality of consciousness can be that which is incarnated in an entity. And that the primordial wisdom pre-exists any entity that it cognizes it. That's parallel to this conception of self-existent constitutive consciousness, contrasting to another phase of consciousness which cognizes. Constitutive consciousness and cognizing consciousness are thus to be distinguished. I made that distinction in my own language, then I ran onto that distinction in those words there. That is the first verification I ran across.
Is there, excuse me, a distinction between that and the position that many mystics hold, that there is no longer a distinction between the subject and object? Is it that they have blended into one thing?
Yes, then that becomes
returned to one thing.
What I call knowledge through identity, in which later I found on a bender is called knowledge by identity, where the cognizer becomes identical with the cognizer. But I'm even going back to that. To this pure field of consciousness as underlying and that being the root of the cognized and the cognizer, even when they're blended. I don't know whether I make the conception clear.
And this is not from, you know, any acquaintance with this, but just from word that is Plato talks about light, between the sun and its light. And he says this is what brings the power of knowing, and on the other hand it brings the power of being known.
Mm-hmm.
So it is prior to being known and knowing light.
And light is being always a symbol of consciousness.
Yes, I certainly got 65, but there's something dead.
Light means consciousness. Although I have used it in the sense of I've identified with the cognitive aspect of consciousness. All right. I'm getting a little afield. But what I'm getting to is that this book is based upon this material. And I developed a schema to get back to our original problem of how can a metaphysical knowledge be possible, to the effect that there is a threefold cognitive function. There's three cognitive functions instead of two. That one of them is generally latent in the human psyche, not active. Two of them generally active. But they, however, can be awakened. This third one can be awakened. It is awakened. The awakening of it is what we know as yoga. I'm using yoga as a term going beyond simply God-realization or self-realization at the moment. I invented a name called it introceptual cognition, or the introceptual organ, visaging, therefore, three forms of cognition, not implying that there may not be more. Aurobindo's schema indicates that he has found one, but implying that here we have at least three, an in-centered conceptual cognition, below perceptual cognition, and above introceptual cognition. But between, at the border between these zones of cognition, there is a point of hiatus, or point of discontinuity. In my experience, the passing over that zone always involved a blackout, and then inversion of consciousness in some sense. As for instance, to carry through self-analysis until you reach down to a point which is bare power of cognition. I am that. No, actually, you cannot put it as an object before your consciousness. It has to stand purely as a subject which never becomes objective. And the move, I was as near as I could tell it, is you sink back into it, the door opens. Now, that pure self that's subjective and is surrounded by the universe of objects is like a point, has position, but no mass. In other words, it has no objectivity ever. Passing this point of discontinuity where there's a blackout and an immediate awakening, the value of the I or self becomes that of an illimitable sphere that contains the cognized universe of all objects. Hence, it's an inversion. Use the term, and Aurobindo used it in his way. You get other inversion. So that an inversion in consciousness seems to be the typical pattern involved in making any of these crossings. And I try to keep that movement, that shift, open between these two, conscious all the way. I couldn't do it. It made me dizzy trying. There would be a blackout and immediate waking to another order, and I've gone down and up, and was in a lucid state and could do it. Can't do it anymore. Now that discontinuity is where our problem arises. If I talk in conceptual terms, as I do, or anything that I say is something conceptual, necessarily, concerning an interceptual subject matter, I know, first of all, what I'm talking about, like the man who's giving a conceptual picture of color. But I don't know what I'm rousing in the consciousness of the individual region. What do those concepts mean to him? What do they indicate to him? That's why I want a feedback. It might indicate to him something that I wouldn't care to be responsible for. And that has happened. You know the story of Buddha? When he went forward to seek the solution of the problem of suffering. It was obviously a search involving experimental effort. One experiment of 6 years with extreme asceticism, which he decided was a mistake. After regaining his strength, he sat under the Bodhi tree, so the account goes, and said he would not leave that position or eat again until he found the solution. And then it is said that he was enlightened under the Bodhi tree. Afterwards, he never attempted to communicate the content of the enlightenment. For that material is ineffable. It will not fit correctly any conceptual form. Any conceptual statement is necessarily a distortion, even though it may reveal something. So he contented himself with teaching a moral system and certain meditative practices designed to lead to a similar awakening, and then spent a lot of time showing that the state of enlightenment was not any possible conception that anybody could possibly have. And it is not this, not that, not everything. If you were take the universe of discourse from which you divide everything into A and not A, it's not A and it's not not A. I know what he's talking about, but there's something he didn't mean that fits that condition, and that is absolute annihilation. There are many, even followers and non-followers, who interpret his meaning as that. And that was a great error. There's always the possibility that your conceptual transcription can produce an effect quite different from what you have in mind. Well, how would the man born blind imagine the colors to be that were described by the man who made the description of them? What would his imagination lead him to from those words? The same problem exists when you deal with a conceptual transcription from an introceptual subject matter. But the value of it is, I see it, or I hope it is, may be, is that dwelling upon the conceptual records will tend to arouse something of the original consciousness from which it came. In other words, a kind of yoga. That's the hope. Hope in the manuscript. I had envisaged when I left Harvard that if I found I was successful, I would come back, I would bring back to the academy what I found. But I hope was that the idea might gain enough recognition at least to be disagreed with. And the floor of the seminar. I don't care whether a person agrees with the ideas or whether he fights them. If he fights them, he's hooked. If he gets an emotional affect, he's hooked ultimately. Only there's magic in this stuff. I know what I'm talking about. If you take anything that comes from a fundamental realization, it has effects. Buddhism started not with the birth of a prince, but with the enlightening realization of the Bodhi. There have been hundreds of millions of people influenced more or less by that. That event starts with that realization. What happens in the realization? In Akiyama's term, at the basic, you have an event in the collective psyche. If there's just one individual that can receive it, accept it, and assimilate it, it's established in the collective psyche, and it'll do work. There are persons who would be justified in being afraid to read that manuscript. There is such a thing as psychic contagion. Persons can be not ready for it. We've demonstrated inductions as recently deliberately as recently as last January right here in this room. It is possible to induce in receptive individuals glimpses of mystical states of consciousness that compare with reports in Buck's Cosmic Consciousness. What does it? One induction that's very frequent is psychophysical heat. Now, that won't happen so long as I stay on the level of speculative thinking, ordinary thinking. A little shift over becomes the transcriptive thing. And those who are sensitive may have an experience of heat. I don't understand how a purely psychological process can do this, but it does happen. I've seen them sweat, I've seen them throw off their coats. And there are those here that can testify to it too, who have had that experience. Now we're dealing with something that produces effects. It's not merely speculation. I want to emphasize that point. Even though there is in that manuscript portions that are speculative, in the sense, when I make an outline of naturalism and I go through the philosophies to show where I stand, I make a brief statement of these different forms. Describe naturalism or neorealism, that's purely speculative, ordinary academic thinking. It's something you know you can do.
This thing you're talking about, this resonating effect that you can have upon other people, I've noticed this many times, but I'm trying to critically analyze what's going on, and of course it's difficult because there's not much too much written about this. And there may be, I haven't read it, but
I don't think there is too much written.
But I do notice that it's almost like a chameleon changes its color or an octopus changing its color to fit the surroundings and the shape to fit the surroundings. It's almost an inbuilt resonating factor, this third thing that you're talking about. And, I notice with different people, it's stronger, and with others, there's a leveling effect, a resonating effect, just almost like a sound resonating effect. And I may be talking to someone who every day they don't seem to have anything, you know, they don't have any philosophical concepts. The next time I confront this person, they turn into a Buddha. What's coming out of this person, I can't believe it. They're talking to me, it's a regular conversation, and yet the effect of this conversation and the words that they're saying at a different level are such that it produces some form of a transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as if they're speaking unquestionable truth. And it comes and goes with various people, and it's unpredictable.
You know, it would be good Buddhist doctrine to say there's a Buddha in every man. It lies there latent. In a certain condition, you might pull it forth from one who didn't even know it was there.
Well, sometimes I've gotten myself in this precarious position that I'll be in a room. There'll be a number of people, and they all have this. I snap into this thing, and they have you can call it super clarity, super intellect, whatever you want to call it. It's whatever they say is profound, and sometimes I'm not leveling, I'm suppressed, and I feel as if they're somewhat, let's say, more enlightened than I am in a sense. And at other times I feel level, and sometimes I feel greater. And the most harmonious relationship and less tension, because whenever there is tension, whenever there's a misleveling, there's a tension that's produced in me, and I feel it as pain, terrible pain. But as the leveling occurs, the pain goes away. And it's a very, very beautiful experience right at the leveling aspect where everyone is at the same level, but at a tremendously high level.
Would you regard that word level as equivalent to the principle of equilibrium?
Maybe. But it's as if the truth is flowing. And there's such perfect harmony. It's just a total harmony within the system. And I don't even know if the others are aware of this, what is happening. Because later I talk to them about it, and they say, yes, something happened, but they don't remember.
They don't know what it was.
They don't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I can question it later, and something happened. There was something recognized. But then we all fall back into our habit pattern mold of every day.
The known word Buddha has a twofold meaning. One, our usual one, we identify it with a certain entity. Actually, it means enlightenment. It's a real word meaning of the word. And when you say Buddha from out, it could be a reference really to a quality of consciousness that was latent there.
I'm beginning to see where that latent potential was. In fact, I was talking about that today with somebody at work, the latent potential, in another way, another symbolic form.
This is interesting. And Dr. Rymel told the young people to give you one of these volumes, one I would request, if you were so inclined, and have an objective review of it, if you were willing to do that.
Oh, yes, I am. I very much want to.
When I say objective, disregard the fact that you know me.
But the objective is that In a formal sense, it means that in a human sense,
yeah.
It doesn't mean the same thing.
That is a thing.
We all try to be objective, say, in a logical sense.
Yeah.
And that's, in a certain sense, easier. You can notice whether things follow from other things.
Yeah.
But that, you need more than that, of course.
I know.
So in one sense, I think you need something subjective typically.
Well, that's true. But I don't want you to feel sensitive about my being about it. Because it doesn't do me any good if it is colored because of my on pathways, I only had one reviewer that was competent. He was J. William Lloyd, man of 80 then, he was a mystic, enlisted in Buck's book, Cosmic Consciousness, is one of his pieces. He wrote two books that were borrowed upon his experience, one, Dawn Thought, and the second, follow-up of Life's Beautiful Battle. He was a poet, he wrote several essays. In his last years, he was a saintly figure. We happened to live only 5 miles from where we were living at the time. I took the manuscript to him. And he was the only person that was anywhere near competent to give evaluation. He gave me a very nice one. But the publisher of the book sent it around to the standard reviewers, and they were all afraid of it. They're afraid of it because the hookup picked out some insignificant feature, and they gave it a mild compliment. They didn't touch the substance of it at all. I don't think they knew what it was, and they may have felt that to criticize it adversely would put them on out on limb. So they just gave meaningless small compliments. I want to get competent and critical evaluation if that is possible. There are two things.
I was thinking about what William James said, that you know, he said, I'm not a mystic, but I have a feeling for this.
I know.
And I think you have to, if you're going to do something like that, you have to have at least some feeling for it.
Well, I think you have it. It's my sense you do.
Well, I think that myself.
Yeah. I have that other conversation with you, and I read that on. But you did have that sympathetic feeling. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you really had the full thing, they'd probably fire you from the university. I know another one. You know Dr. Goya?
Oh, at Flagstaff.
Yeah.
Yes, I have met him. I don't know him very well. I've seen him at a couple of meetings.
All right. He tried to go both ways, and he's been trying ever since to go both ways, but at a price. At the price of being persona non grata with the authorities in the university.
Well, the department split up there, the philosophy, humanities.
Yeah. They took away his course. He was Oriental philosophy with the pronouncement there's no such thing as Oriental philosophy.
Oh, that's a very analytically oriented department up there now.
He said, haven't you got a history? He says we really don't have a department. I said, haven't you got a history of philosophy? No. Introduction to philosophy? No. Well, I said, we don't have a philosophy department. He says we really don't. He says it's all positivism. I don't even know what he said.
Yes, or another, I mean, a more recent version. But, I mean, it certainly has changed, but right? It's a very active department, though. I mean, the philosophy, what was called philosophy.
I see. Well,
something may come of it.
I don't know. Yeah. I only know what he said.
Yes, it is. So as long as they're alive, and I hear they do battle a great deal there. People say that, you know, from the other end of the campus as they approach the building, the philosophers, they can hear them, you know, above the high wind. So there may be some hope there anyway.
Well, of course, he and Vasant Murtaugh, Merchant, are very good friends.
How is she now?
We're going there on our way out. We'll be down there at least a couple of nights. And last time I saw her was last January. She was down here. She gradually can get around a little more easily. A little more adeptly with her crutches. But I think she still sits in a wheelchair lecturing. I gave half a dozen lectures at her house to students that came, and there I talked my stuff in her house. I said to her, you better not try to have it in the university room because it might put you in a bad light with the powers that be. She rather agreed, so we had it at her house. And I guess I was correct on that. Later she was going to have Walker over for an evening meal to meet us, the president. And she wanted to come, but I said, no, that would hurt you if I'm seen here by Walker. Well, there are problems with that. And in a way, I think what going at is a sort of sacrificial lamb in the whole matter. Now, he told me that when he was looking for his doctrine, at the same time, he's trying to keep on the beam of yoga, of yogic realization. He said there was so much conflict between the two that it induced a very painful attack of shingles. And the man is in the midst of the fight of it. Now, I made the break with the academic, and I avoided that. Faced the other problem of losing a career in the academic field. But I think I've made a better and more comfortable journey after talking to Dr. Goyen.
I think we're really quite lucky down here. It's possible to do more things. I mean, there isn't a sense of sort of snobbish sense to that. You know, the way Perry put it, it's about the intellectual underworld.
Now, I found something. I was astonished about these young students. The revolving students go all the way from a bottom that is virtually criminal and seems it comes out of the sewer up to a very precious lot that are brilliant, and they're wide open for anything of the sort as anything like a mystical realization. We had drawing groups at our room. There wasn't nearly enough chairs to sit on, so they sat on the floor. You were up there, weren't you? Well, they had to sit on the floor. Last time, 65 persons there, and I had about this much space to talk to. There were legs sticking out here all around. And those young people sitting in that awkward position gave me the closest and the best attention I ever had. They were almost ecstatic. I realize there's some mighty fine stuff that's coming in at the present time in these young people. Now, you might call them the crown of the revolving students.
Santa Barbara is a very unusual situation. At Santa Barbara, it's an unusual situation.
Well, that is a video of that criminal album, the firm building.
Well, no, but I mean Raglan Iyer, for instance, who teaches political science, and his wife teaches philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a great many students who are rightly interested in what you're interested in, a kindred nature.
Well, Young says you find the pearl beyond price in the mud, and among these students, revolving, and some of them look as though they came out of the sewer and act as though they came out of the sewer, but among them you seem to have this pearl without price. Well, I think I've said enough.
I wouldn't say that.
We live above our own time, about 6,000 feet. And we control 400 acres, so there's nobody near us if we don't want. And I find it very convenient to talk to the tape. In fact, it seems to be a better medium than writing right now. You can talk to an abstract audience, not to a specific audience before you. And finding it's a fairly adequate vehicle. And in that setting, you're about 6,000 feet out. And the mountains around you, the valley below you, about 2,000 feet down. And we're very close to the highest mountain south of Alaska. Mount Whitney. in very favorable condition.
I'd like to build an ivory tower to that place, and then you could go a little higher.
You don't need to build it. It's enough of a tower as it is. Let the ground be the tower. So I'm putting it down there, and Jim takes copies of these tapes. And it's become now a vehicle of communication. Last night we put on a tape, it saved me a minute. I developed this conception of the three organs, faculties, or functions. I'm not willing to say yet that there's no truth in faculty psychology, so I included it in there. It's of course our style today to think of it as only functional. But I don't know that there's falsity in the previous idea, but it's all function. So I retain the possible thought that there may be a valid use for the notion of faculty in spite of John Locke. But that the basic conception that's in this book that I try to elaborate through part one, two, three, and four, part two really should be the last one, is build the presumption for a third faculty or function of cognition. Maintaining that gets around the block of metaphysical and psychological criticism as presented by Immanuel Kant and Dr. Carl J. Jung. And then what is now part two, but which really should be part four, commentaries on the aphorisms on consciousness without an object, will be part of the actual content produced from that function. And it's somewhat the analogous to the contrast to samadhi and prajna, as it is discussed by the sixth patriarch in Chan Buddhism. Now those aphorisms are probably meaningless except for the commentaries. I'll take five. Consciousness without an object is, and by the way, I explain that consciousness without an object is also consciousness without something. Consciousness without an object is. Before objects were, consciousness was not, without an object is. When objects seem to exist, consciousness without an object is. When objects vanish, yet remaining unaffected through all, consciousness without an object is. Beside consciousness without an object, nothing is. That's the first fact. Now, take a paradigm. Nowadays we have the physical conception that energy and matter can be equivalent. That's the basis of the atom bomb. If an electron meets a positron, they would vanish in a flash of radiation, and the radiation would be pure energy. But between the energy, energetic state, and the state as matter, there's something invariant. And I was advised by a trained physicist that something is called energy momentum. Now let's substitute matter for objects and energy momentum for consciousness. Energy momentum is, before matter was, energy momentum is. when matter seems to exist, energy momentum is. When matter vanishes, yet remaining through all unaffected, energy momentum is. Beside energy momentum, there is none other. Parallels, that's a conceptual parallel of three first apparatus. Suggestion is that it isn't meaningless. Most people feel that it is meaningless when they first read. And you notice I use is not to mean the present tense, but I mean to suggest timelessness. And there's no other tense I know of to express it by except to use the present tense. So I violate the grammar in there. Do that. There's about 50 of those, and they're with commentaries on them. They're not too simple, although two can understand, they're simple to write. They virtually wrote themselves down in a period of about 2 hours, and then writing a commentary is about the most difficult writing I ever did.
Yeah, I think the very reading of those aphorisms induces a type of consciousness that the words maybe don't say as conceptions, but I think there's an induction there with the answers.
They do have an inductive power, no doubt about it. Anything that comes, there is a difference in state. I can tell it. The ordinary consciousness. Then you have that consciousness where you might say the diamond on your back, or where you're on the beam, you become enthusiastic in the original meaning of the word. And I like the term inverse consciousness combined with our ordinary consciousness called obverse consciousness. Now the inverse consciousness, not much you can say about it, but it can impinge upon ordinary consciousness, the conceptual consciousness, like an impregnating force, leading to conceptual elaboration. Now, it's possible to swing from one to the other. And there's something I call something like a butterfly valve that you can turn as simply as moving a finger. Shift it on, shift it off. It can be under control. You don't have to wait for some great power that it's possible to have it under control. Now the point is to get an interaction between the two. The great temptation is to go into the depth consciousness because it's always ineffable. There is no experience of delight or of beauty or of sweetness that we know in ordinary life that can in the faintest degree suggest what you get in that depth consciousness. Maybe the threshold of nirvana. It's a very intriguing thing, hold it. Now many psychologists do acknowledge that experiences of affective delight do exist, and that it may have an effect, as Buck puts it, in cosmic consciousness of producing moral elevation. But men like John Dewey, who have acknowledged that, Bertrand Russell, who acknowledged it in Logic and Mysticism, James H. Luba, who dealt with the psychology of religious mysticism, and he mentions a man by the name of Delaroe and one by the name of Coy, all acknowledge the factuality of mystical states of consciousness, that they produce a state of delight, and that they can have a certain exerting effect on the individual, but deny that they have no eritas, that is, knowledge by them. Dreams and varieties of religious experience acknowledges the noetic value. I have them right here. Ineffability. The inability to express the content. Noetic quality, and these two are fundamental. Transiency and passivity. I don't quite agree with all. It does not necessarily have to be so transient as he thinks. He says not more than 2 hours. It can persist for protracted intervals. And they're not necessarily passive anymore. But he didn't have the whole story. He only studied typically mainly Western mystics, and Western mystical history is different from the Oriental. The Oriental aims at a certain control, whereas it just has to do with the Western mystics. When you read the Western mystics, I advise you not to get your impression simply from persons like Marguerite, Catherine, Teresa, St. John of the Cross, or Suso, or Madame Guyon. If you take them like Plotinus, Meister Eckhart, and Jacob Behme. And Jacob Behme, for instance, has been valued highly by certain of the post-Kantian idealists. As you no doubt know, that one of them says Jacob Behme is not a philosopher, but a subject of philosophy. You get a very different impression. Oh, some of those girls were not in a power position at all with respect to their experiences, and they were utterly vulnerable to unflattering Freudian interpretations. But wait, take a powerful figure like Plotinus, one like Meister Eckhart, and Jacob Behme. You get a very different understanding of it from what you would from these others. And James did dip a good deal into the all these simpler forms of Christian mysticism. Christian mysticism is only one form of it. James Luba said that the knowledge the mystic brings out is the knowledge he takes into the state, that it is not a state, it is not a source of knowledge. And of course, you get this evidence. The Christian mystic will confirm a Christian presupposition. Catholic mystic will be different from the Protestant mystic, and will be favor the Catholic priest conceptions. An Indian mystic will tend to follow and confirm Indian preconceptions. They can build a pretty strong argument that way. I know that I came out of the one that is reported in the first section of Pathways with no change in my philosophy. I've been studying Shankara and I got this thing, which was along the line of Shankara. There was no change there, but when the high end difference came, it was a revolution in my philosophic outlook. So I know it can be a source of knowledge. But it also is possible that it'll tend to confirm your predilections, your religious predilections.
What the Christian calls being born again, that would be the true realization, wouldn't it?
Not necessarily. No, that's more or less of a formula. There is authentic rebirth phenomenon, but that's a pretty major thing. pretty major and it's pretty thoroughgoing. He did a pretty radical upheaval.
The inversion of consciousness, you don't equate that with, or do you equate that with this third state?
The crossing over.
The crossing
third over involves an inversion in consciousness.
But the actual state in the inversion
is most natural.
In the inversion, I've had things that are what you might call inversion, where I've had an objective experience, or experiencing the object. And later on, down the line, that same experience, I re-experience as the object, experiencing myself looking at the object.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you would call that an inversion.
The inversion has more than one pattern.
Yeah. That was, and I've had a number of similar type of things that on that vein. I don't know what to do with it.
It
just happened. I don't know what to say about the
world. By the way, do you talk of these experiences to your friends much?
Friends that I can talk to, yes.
That you can.
Yes.
Do you have many of them?
I have, there are several.
Well, that is... There may be an increasing crop of this type.
One student was telling me about a dream, and he described it in such a way that he was looking at himself as an object.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I mean, who was looking at you? And then he began to realize there was something strange about it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I don't know if
you... It seemed like the perfectly, you know, normal way to have a dream to him, apparently.
Yeah. Similar to
this thing is similar to, I think, Dali's painting of the universe in terms of a man with all of his organs on the outside, and the whole universe is on the inside. All the planets, galaxies, and the whole universe is within the person. His organs are on the outside. And this is a sort of symbolic expression, I think, of some of the things that...
Have you ever gotten into trouble by talking to the wrong person?
I did earlier, yes. I thought I was insane. But I talked to the wrong people. But I was naive at that. I still am naive, but at that time I was much, much more naive than I have now.
There's so much in literature like that Plato that suggests this, that, you know, the soul is the outer envelope, the tineus,
mm-hmm.
of the body. And then he says, well, of course, the soul, I'm saying that the body is created first, actually, the soul. And inside of that, body.
Mm-hmm.
I
always assumed that Plato was a man of realization,
mm-hmm.
that he was an authentic, what the Oriental would call a yoga.
In the seventh letter, I think that's very clear.
Yeah.
And even his giving advice to others about this thing.
Well, I think he's one of the perennial philosophers.
But then, of course, you have to... Gilbert Ryle, who says, no, the seventh letter is genuine. it's sometimes it's genuine, sometimes it's not genuine.
It depends on the critic's prejudice.
Yeah, now we may be in for a phase that it's not being genuine.
There's another thing that I've come across, and that's what I might want to call a transfer of consciousness. Where consciousness is seated into some other object, and you begin to identify so strongly with it. Well, we do this, and most everybody do this. But I've had some experience, a ridiculous experience. Like one time, I turned into a third one. and I started crawling through the ground, and all I was...
That's the way you felt.
That's the way I felt, and I was feeling. I could not see, all I could do was feel. And I was, it was a total feeling of being an earthworm, which was so strong and intense. It wasn't like a, you know, it was during a meditation that this happened. And it was a... I don't know, it's just
speak to this fellow. Do you feel wholly comfortable sitting beside him?
He hasn't said what his experiences are yet.
Well, is it a common experience, to make a gesture, to say something and think, oh, I am, say, my father or someone else, in that particular gesture that you make, there's a feeling of identity. But that's not the same thing as, jumping into some other...
No, this is participating in the consciousness of the worm. Of course, it is said in the literature that it's possible, all right.
Well, I've done it with other animals, too. And I've had some very interesting things. It's so surprising when these things happen. I never know what to expect, but unusual things happen, and then I later analyze this and say, I don't take it for a reality or non-reality. I don't make any judgment on these things. They just happen. And if they repeat, there's maybe a degree or ringing of pattern or truth or whatever you want to call it to it. And that's all I can say. And but there are some experiences that you have a fixation of it's almost like an absolute feeling that this is the way it is, and they're very hard to shake.
Yeah, they're more fundamental. Well, of course, we can't say. There's plenty of reason why we can't say that, because a state is psychologically classed as a state. As the type mystic, but therefore it is authoritative. There are great mystical experiences that do carry an authoritative value, so long as they're not interpreted. I keep them on their pure level.
Interpretation in the midst of an experience, if I try the analytic, I can jump out and analyze and split myself. But every time I do that, it destroys part of the intensity of the
True.
Experience that's taking place.
True, but if you wanted to communicate, if you had a value you wanted to communicate to someone else, you'd be justified in sacrificing something.
You have to tag some symbol to get a genetic coding to bring it back. You want to bring something back. But today, modern science is taking many interesting paths now due to developments in mathematics. The sciences are becoming very mystical, especially the theoretical sciences and astronomy, for example. You're getting all sorts of, topology is being applied to astronomy and also to particle physics. And the concepts are so unusual as Einstein's concepts.
Well, they are virtually mystical.
Yeah, mystical in their nature, and many of them are quite accepted. Maybe many of them will turn out to be what we call the truth. These are the foreground of
course, he wasn't dogmatic about it. He used the figure that. Newton got a first approximation, and his is a second approximation, and made the other approximation further along the line. I was surprised, so that it could be transitory. Even he was prepared for that. But nonetheless, there is something. Well, Sir Isaac Newton only spent a small portion of his life in science, a larger portion went into mystical interest.